Sea Realm Podcast, Episode 6, Starting Small.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm Camo, your host for the next 45 minutes or so. During that time, I'll be talking with two guests on the topic of producing food. More specifically, I will talk with my two guests about how we can increase the level of consciousness and responsibility that we take in the matter of learning where our food comes from and making deliberate choices about the kinds of food we want to ingest and the kinds of farming practices we wish to sponsor with our spending. My first guest, organic gardening guru Calvin Bay, lives on two increasingly suburban acres on the outskirts of Fayetteville, Arkansas. After hearing about Calvin Bay and speaking to him on the phone, I expected a homestead far more rustic and rural in its aesthetic than what I found. Calvin and Doris Bay's house, which they had designed and built for them, has won national awards for energy efficiency. The Bay's home, open and full of light, features a central wood-burning fireplace and oven encased in soapstone that continued to radiate heat into the afternoon from a fire which had burned itself out the night before. You can find photos of Calvin Bay in his garden and in his home, along with extended show notes for this episode on my blog, kmo.livejournal.com. After introductions and a brief explanation about the nature of podcasting and about the thematic flavor of my show, we started with a tour of the garden and then came inside and settled in at the kitchen table for our sit-down interview. We'll drift into that now.
I've done that before. I usually do it in two sessions or three sessions. But people don't want to drive. Get the coat off.
For the purposes of this interview, I'm interested more in staying to the larger topics rather than the specifics of organic gardening.
Sure.
I'm very much of the opinion that a good part of gardening involves animals. So I keep chickens, you know, for the manure and for the eggs. I'd keep larger animals if I could spend more time at home, but I don't. So chickens are fairly easy to care for.
We've considered that here. In fact, there's some property right behind us that we wanted to buy another acre, and at that time we were saying, well, you know, we'll do chickens. Now we're in the city.
Yeah. You didn't move, the city came to you.
So that's out.
So you can't keep chickens at all, or you just can't have roosters?
I don't think we'd have any chickens in the city now. In fact, there was an ordinance a covenant in the subdivision before the building that, you know, besides the building construction codes or requirements, something about animals.
Well, tell me a little bit about your history and your credentials as a USDA. Are you a scientist?
Yes. I went to Michigan State in the 50s and have a degree in forestry.
Okay.
And so my interest has always been, you know, the natural kinds of things and trees. However, after a master's degree at Michigan State, I decided to go and study genetics. And so I went back to Iowa State and got a PhD in genetics. And my career was pretty much in the area of genetics of trees, long-term kinds of things, see. And that's always fit me particularly well because I've always been interested in the bigger, more holistic picture, bringing things together, doing more conceptual stuff, and I guess I was successful as a scientist, but it was always wanting to bring other disciplines together and bring that all together. So after 20 years, maybe a little less than that, I started in managing research units, and that took me from where I was in Illinois to Mississippi, and then to Alaska, and then I went to Washington, D.C., and headed up the forest management research for all of the Forest Service, as well as being their coordinator for strategic planning for all Forest Service users. So, got a big picture perspective in that forestry area. Mm-hmm. And then the gardening and other things, that was always just an interest. And I was raised on a farm in Michigan, so came kind of natural that I tell the story that when I left the farm, I said goodbye, good riddance. But before we were married 6 months, I was at the hardware store buying shovels and forks to start turning the soil over for starting a garden.
Kind of hard to get away from it.
And I couldn't leave it. Never had. So.
Well, good. I'm glad you have it.
Yeah. No, it's very much ingrained in part of me, and I can't help that. So that's kind of my background, and mm-hmm. we've moved around a lot. I've gardened in each of those places. I've dealt with lots of people issues, big issue kinds of problems, and I'm not into it in far as like biodynamics and, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing in a big way, but I certainly don't poo-poo any of that stuff. I say there's more to it and a deeper level than just getting the right fertilizers in your garden and having a good compost and a good that kind of a thing. So, and certainly the whole compost arena, and that's what Steiner and John Jevons are very much about. That's so critical.
Mm-hmm. Feeding the soil.
Yep. Yeah. So, though I haven't moved in that direction, the direction I have moved from organic into the bigger arena would be, I don't know exactly, eco-agriculture, alternative agriculture, whatever you want to call that today, but since moving here 5 years ago, became very familiar with the Acres USA and all their publications. They write a lot of things. And
I'm not familiar with Acres USA.
Okay. It's the biggest alternative agriculture organization in the world.
Okay.
And I'll be at a meeting in December in St. Paul where they are bringing 1,000 or more people together. And they are the most, well, not just the largest, but certainly the most knowledgeable and the most out front of anybody. And alternative agriculture doesn't mean organics, and it doesn't mean that it's not organic in the sense that sometimes you have to tweak beyond what you can get. For example, I need manganese. Mm-hmm. I did a soil test here with a lab from Minnesota. I need manganese. Well, I don't know that there's a source of manganese. All I need is 2 ounces for these 2,000 square feet.
Right.
Well, I'm not afraid to put a manganese sulfate on there, whether it's tested and approved by the organic certification or not. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean by tweaking a little bit beyond strictly organic. There's a little bit of a danger sometimes with the thinking only organics in this sense, that people think, well, all you have to do is add compost, add more compost. It's sort of like the 50s, 60s, 70s with the whole agriculture research program. They thought the answer to everything was either develop a hybrid or add more fertilizer.
Yep.
And the add more fertilizer bit meant nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And of course, we know what has happened to the agriculture.
Well, not everybody listening to this podcast knows what's happened. So,
well,
why don't you go into that for a little
sure,
bit?
Sure, sure. If we take a look at what's happening to our soils in the United States and in the field of agriculture, we'll find that they're greatly depleted. And we say, well, gosh, we've been adding this nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Yes, we have. But the microelements or the secondary elements are very much deficient. And that translates into, in the end, poor health for us.
How so?
Well, in the sense that our bodies need at least 60, maybe 90 different elements to function properly. And the only way we're going to get them, unless we take supplements, and I'm not opposed to taking supplements, I take supplements, is to have it in the soil where the plants can use it, and the produce is full of it. So I do a test here with a refractometer to see how nutrient dense, how sugar content, and really, alternative agriculture folks are very much into this, but conventional, I'm going to say chemical farmer, and that's what it really is boiled down to, is not. And it's been bins and bushels. That's the theme of the research, and very seldom will you see, did you see, there's a little more of it now, did you ever see the analysis of the produce from the standpoint of the nutrients.
Well, it's my understanding that for years the United States Department of Agriculture, for obvious reasons, favored large-scale, what I call industrial farming, and poo-pooed organic farming as a concept, and this organization that had for so long taken a dim view of organic gardening was suddenly given the authority to define what is and is not organic. Prior to their being given the power to certify what is and is not organic, the insistence of the government, at least, was that an organic potato is no different from a potato grown by dumping, you know, the NPK fertilizer into otherwise sterile soil.
I'd say that's all exactly true. It was probably in the 60s and 70s where the big farmer was favored to the extreme, because in fact one of the secretaries of agriculture said, "Get bigger, get out."
Yeah.
Well, that's unfortunate in this sense. Small farmers, especially local farmers that can provide, just think of the energy cost for our food today. For on the average, if you go to buy produce in the grocery store, that produce has traveled 1,500 miles.
Yep.
I've even seen estimates of 2,000. And as we get more stuff from foreign countries, that's probably going to go up. Well, somebody's driving a truck or something to very little train travel, so probably came from a truck from 1,500 miles away, and that favors being big.
Yeah.
So
one reason I don't make a religion out of being organic is that I operate on the maxim that it is better to eat local food than to eat food that's been trucked in from a long distance. And it's better to eat food that was grown locally, even if some chemical fertilizers and pesticides were involved, than to eat organic lettuce, which has been trucked halfway across the country and is metaphorically soaked in fossil fuels. You know, it might be organic.
Yes.
But they burned a lot of gasoline to get it to you.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I'm a pretty big protector of... don't use pesticides on your gardens, and to the extent possible. And I know that is possible, but certainly local is the way to go.
Yep.
And I just promote organic gardening because I want everybody to start doing a little bit for themselves. They don't have to have 2,000 or 3,000 square feet and get, as I do, 1,500 pounds of produce off of that piece of land there. But if they get 50 pounds of tomatoes and share it with a few neighbors, and don't have to worry about eating lettuce from California or spinach or whatever, when they've got their own, well, we're saving energy. And the concept of sustainability is so important. And so I want people to be thinking in terms of sustainability too. And you know, we have a container at the sink, And everything that organic peelings and everything goes in that container.
Yeah.
And that goes on the compost pile. That goes back into the garden. Leaves, whatever.
It goes to my house, except all the kitchen scraps go to the chickens.
Everything is recycled and used. And, oh gosh, we could save on energy and fertilizer so much if we would just get...
Just stop throwing away the kitchen scraps, the gold.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful! Thank you.
Oh, you just picked it.
Let me back up just a little bit. We were talking about government standards, government attitudes towards big industrial farming versus small alternative farming, and the position for years was that there is no difference in terms of the quality of the food. But what I was struck by the materials that you have emailed to me is that you have a very specific and scientific criteria for explaining the difference in quality between foods that are grown on a big industrial scale with chemicals versus foods that are grown by feeding the soil and encouraging the biotic life in the soil and the natural balance of nutrients and microorganisms. You have some very specific metrics. Would you talk about those?
Well, I guess you're referring to the nutrient dense and mm-hmm. use of the fractometer. And you know, you can really almost predict what you're going to get in the produce if you do a soil analysis and get the balance right. And so, yes, you're going to have more calcium in your oats, whatever it is you're growing, is going to be heavier and it'll be denser and it'll have more nutrients in it. Now, can you miss with just doing it organically? Yes, you can. You want to be careful. The most important thing, you've got to have the nutrient level up to a certain a sort of threshold or minimum level, but it's being sure that it's balanced. I'm just reading a book now called Minerals for the Genetic Code, and it's extremely important.
Who's the author of that?
This is Charles Walters, and he's the person who started Acres USA 35 years ago.
Okay.
It's not a how-to book, but it's perhaps the most revolutionary idea to come along. I was talking with a friend last night, Benny Warren, I said to him, I think that this is the most revolutionary idea, or maybe there may be one or two in between, since Watson and Crick put the double helix concept together in 1953 with virus genetics. And the theme is that now we can take a look at the human genome, decipher that, and translate that into minerals required, particularly for genes, meaning a function, a portion of the chromosome that has a particular function, and we know those sequences, genetic sequences, you know, the code kind of a thing. And knowing that, and this particular... Charles Walters didn't do it. Richard Olry, a chiropractor in Hillman, Michigan, did the basic work, and it's all developed within the last year or two. And he's been working on it for 25 years, but mm-hmm. he's put it together. And so we're now saying the application of all this is human diseases, as defined previously, are all upside down. It's all wrong. What we really have are broken genes caused by toxicities, radiation, deficiencies, and in our food. I mean, can't make a particular kind of protein if you don't have boron, or if you don't have cobalt, or selenium, or iodine. And if you don't have the ratios right, then one substitutes for another, and you still have a problem. So I could go on and on about fluorine and iodine, see, because there's a big issue right there. Fluorine in our water mm-hmm. will substitute for iodine. the iodine molecule and fluorine model, both same valence, and they're interchangeable. You put too much of one in, it substitutes for the other.
Mm-hmm.
It substitutes, but it doesn't go into the system, but it doesn't do the same to the same function. So, thyroid problems? Probably. I won't say, I'm not a medical doctor, but I won't say, you know, that this is it, but there's certainly evidence to promote getting all those balances right and keeping the toxins down.
What are your thoughts on fluoridating public water?
Thumbs down.
Why do you say that?
Well, for just what I was just talking about, because of the substitution. And fluorine, well, there's a long history of that, and you've got a person right up there in your neighborhood, I forgot his person that you should spend some time with and talk about just the water situation in the fluoridation. He'll give you far more information than I can, but I've for many years now been opposed to fluoridating our water. About a lot of things.
And ignorance and apathy.
Ignorance and apathy, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I try to be a pretty patient person. I've done a lot of I've worked with people and been to Haiti 20 times working with a mission down there, doing agriculture. I'm a volunteer after I retired. And so I've learned to be extremely patient as to try to get people moving in the right direction. And that's what I usually say. I said, listen, it's not so important where you are today. And this is kind of a general philosophy for me. Not so important that you be on the top rung as it is, are you moving up the ladder or are you moving in the direction of sustainability? And that's far more important. Get people moving, keep them moving so they don't get into it. Because that's really what's happened. I don't think people are just, gardeners and yard people. I don't think they're out to poison the earth. They don't have a plan for this. They just don't know any better for the most part. And when you start telling them there are alternatives, and we've got some cultural things that, it's very easy to get in the trap. I want a nice looking lawn, see? And everybody wants a nice looking lawn. Well, you know, that's the third priority in my outside here. Yes, I want a nice looking lawn. If I can do that in an organic or without using pesticides and chemicals, I'm going to have it. So, first of all,
you are listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
The more we learn about where our food comes from, and the more we become aware of alternate choices we can make about how we want to feed ourselves, the more I think we will gravitate toward eating foods produced close to home, on small, heterogeneous farms where farmers artfully balance livestock with food plants to feed the soil. The more we add quality of life for both farmer and farm animal to the list of recognized variables in our economic calculations, the more we start formulating goals for ourselves, like those of our next guest. In her book, Small-Scale Livestock Farming, A Grass-Based Approach for Health, Sustainability, and Profit, Carol Icarius describes the holistic goals that she and her husband, Ken Woodard, have formulated for themselves. She writes, "First, we want to live in places off the beaten track. We want to feast our eyes on spectacular views of rugged mountain vistas. We want a place with lots of sun, abundant wildlife, and minimal light pollution. We want to sit out at night lost in a sea of stars, listening for the serenade of song dogs, coyotes. Beauty is, in itself, worthy of effort. Second, we want to be as independent as is feasible in this modern age. We want a significant portion of our energy to come from renewable sources, and much of our food to come from the work of our own hands, whether hunting, gathering, or growing. We want the bulk of our living to come from our own endeavors, not jobs. Third, we want to be honorable and honest in our dealings with each other and with other people. We want to be compassionate and respectful in our treatment of other living creatures. We want our actions on the land to be beneficial to the ecosystem. We want to understand and work with ecosystem processes. We want to be contributors, not just takers from society and the earth. We want the world to be a better place for our having passed through. Fourth, we want to do meaningful work, both physically and mentally. Our work needs to keep us in the outdoors and to keep us surrounded by animals. We enjoy work, we take pride in it, and believe that work keeps us healthy and happy. Finally, we have little interest in material possessions, but financial security, with little or no debt, is important to us. We want a small but comfortable home. More important to us than money is time. We want to make time for reading, writing, art, music, travel, and a loving relationship. We want to keep our minds open and expanding, our hearts full and content.
Hi, this is Carol.
Carol Icarius, thank you very much for appearing on the Sea Realm podcast.
It's my pleasure.
I wanted to talk to you because you are further down a particular path that I myself would like to walk. You know quite a bit about keeping animals, keeping livestock, and integrating them into a small farm operation. Tell me a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are and what you're doing now.
Well, my background is kind of a convoluted path to where I am today. I was born and raised in New Jersey, down at the Jersey Shore. We did not have any animals. We did have a little bit of a garden when I was growing up, and my parents gardened organically and were early subscribers to Organic Gardening magazine. But, you know, it was a pretty small garden, mainly Jersey tomatoes and pumpkins and a little bit of lettuce and that kind of thing. When I was 23, I took about a year off from the real world and traveled around the country living in a Toyota Corona and skiing at all the ski areas in the western U.S. And hung out in Southern California and San Diego at the beach for a while and just kind of bummed around. And when it was time to really kind of settle back down, get a real job, that kind of thing again, I decided that I had really loved the mountains in Colorado, so I came back to the Colorado Rockies, got a job, met my husband to be there. We both worked in water and wastewater treatment, so I was working at the sewer plant in Breckenridge, Colorado. And as soon as we met each other, we were kind of kindred souls. We both loved animals and wanted to live out in the country and kind of had this dream of being ranchers or something. So we moved, we bought at least 40 acres out near Kremlin, Colorado. That was our first out-of-town experience. And we bought horses, and we bought chickens and ducks and geese and rabbits, and we bought ourselves a orphan calf that we raised for beef, and that was all kind of the start of this path. In 1989, we decided we really wanted to farm commercially, and we couldn't afford to do so in Colorado. The cost of land here was rather prohibitive. I've always joked you either have to be a rock star or a Rockefeller to own a ranch in Colorado. So we moved to Minnesota, and we farmed there through 1997. We made money at the farm, enjoyed it, but we really wanted to get back to the mountains. So we came back here and are now back on a hobby kind of rancho.
What do you mean by a hobby ranch?
Well, we have 25 acres, which in Colorado in the mountains is not nearly enough to actually do any kind of commercial agricultural enterprise. This is pretty arid country out here, and so we are limited in the amount of production we can do on that size of land. It's not a commercial enterprise, but it fulfills a lot of our personal needs and goals for our lives and gives us the ability to make money off of other creative endeavors like my writing, my husband's music and photography, and that kind of thing.
Marvelous. Well, let me ask you about your hobby ranch now. What are you producing there? What kind of animals do you have?
Well, currently what we have is three horses, two donkeys, two dogs, a very ancient cat who is about 20 years old, and some chickens. We haven't been able to have any other kinds of livestock animals in recent years because we've been in a severe drought since 2002, less than 8 inches of precip a year. But this summer it seemed to break again, and we are getting a little snow so far this winter, so it's possible next spring we may add a couple of lambs. We also have a pretty good-sized garden. We use deep beds, raised beds, and I'm a really big fan of cold frames because in a place like this, between the aridity of the area, the windiness of the area, and the fact that we have a less than 2 month frost-free growing season, cold frames have become an essential tool. A lot of root crops. We do potatoes, beets, turnips, carrots, radishes, onions, garlic, all those kinds of things, because root crops are pretty forgiving here. They can take a little more abuse than some of the non-root crops. We grow lots of greens, lots of herbs. Tomatoes and peppers I do in kind of large water from underneath pots, and then I can start them in those in the spring, move them outside during the frost-free months, and then bring them back in the fall to finish getting my crop off of them. And I'm still picking tomatoes now. And then we have an asparagus bed, a horseradish bed, and we grow a lot of flowers just kind of mixed in throughout the other beds.
For pest control and for beauty?
For pest control and for beauty.
Yep. Tell me, how do your animals interact with your garden? How are those two systems interacting with one another?
Well, you know, animals, one of the great things about having animals from a gardening perspective is manure. I am just a really big fan of manure. sounds probably a bit strange to
not
some
me.
People in the world, but but I love poo. So we do fertilize all the beds with manure, well-aged or composted, and we use the bedding from the chicken pen. We use kind of crummy grass hay for bedding in there, and then use that as mulch over the garden beds when they need mulch. And again, here, because of the harsh climate, mulch is an absolute essential type of thing for these beds. Helps keep the moisture in. So I'm getting double duty out of those things. The chickens are really good at helping to reduce pest problems. You know, they keep a lot of the bugs down. So those are the main things I look at, the benefit of animals for gardening purposes at this point in time. Some animals you can also use, like pigs, to break up areas that are going to be a garden in the future. You know, stick a pig out there 1 year, and the next year you've got really well-cultivated soil. That's especially nice in hard soil places, like in a lot of the areas of Arkansas, say, or the eastern parts of the country where you get deep-rooted weeds and all. After a short period of time, the hogs will have everything out of all the weed roots and everything out of the ground.
Well, that's something for me to think about on my land.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you didn't have a lot of land by your standards, but you do have 40 acres, is that right?
25
acres.
Right.
Someone who is looking to move in the direction of participating in a more sustainable way of feeding our whole society, they can turn the organic material that they would throw away into fertile soil in which to grow, and they can use animals, and I'm thinking in this case chickens, to help them do that. But you'd have to have some land. What's the smallest parcel of land that you think somebody could reasonably incorporate animals, particularly chickens, into?
Chickens can be incorporated. Chickens or rabbits are another one that are really good for small landowners, and they can be incorporated into a quarter-acre backyard. So you don't have to have 25 acres to have these kind of animals. We used to live in Silver Plume, Colorado, which is an old mining town west of Denver, I don't know, probably 50 miles in the mountains, and we had a quarter-acre lot in town, and we had a little shed out back, and we had chickens, ducks, geese, and rabbits in that little tiny shed out back. You don't need a lot. You know, we had a half a dozen chickens. four rabbit pens, a couple of ducks, and a couple of geese. So you can do that, and we were very popular in the neighborhood. The kids would all come over and see our animals all the time. You know, it was like, oh, there's Crazy Ken and Carol with their pets.
I assume you had no roosters.
No roosters, no. If you're a backyard chicken person, you know, even a lot of cities allow chickens in backyards. So, you know, even you can go into a major metro area and theoretically have 3 to 5 chickens in your backyard. And as long as you don't keep a rooster, you're okay.
So somebody with, say, a dozen chickens in a hen house in the backyard on a half-acre, quarter-acre lot, how would they incorporate those chickens, and how would they harvest the manure, and how would they use that manure to create fertile soil for their garden?
Well, if you had a small pen, like a dog kennel-sized pen, you know, the kind that chain-link fence that you can go buy a pen at Home Depot to keep dogs in, that's
sure.
A great pen for a chicken pen. And a dog house would work in there for 3 to 5 laying hens. Bed it with straw. They poop in there. When you're ready, you pull straw out every so often, compost that straw hay manure mix, and add that to your garden. Or just use the compost or the straw on top of the garden as mulch, and that eventually incorporates down. So on that scale, I mean, you can even do it that small. It doesn't have to be a big enterprise. And those hens will give you eggs. I mean, 5 hens for most families will give them most of the eggs they need during the course of a year.
Are there particular breeds of chicken that you're fond of?
I am particularly fond of the dual-purpose breeds. So, for example, the Plymouth Barred Rocks are really nice backyard chickens.
I have 14 of those.
They are a dual-purpose bird, so they do really well for these kinds of enterprises. If you want to get into more meat, then I'd say maybe Jersey Giants are a good choice. If you really want serious laying and serious egg production, then you can always go with the little leghorn hens or something like that.
Well, I misspoke a moment ago. I said I had 14 of the Plymouth Rock Barred. I actually have 10 of those and 14 Rhode Island Reds.
Ah, the Rhode Island Reds are also a nice dual-purpose bird.
Well, good. That's good to hear.
New Hampshire's are another good dual-purpose bird. So there's a bunch of them. Actually,
whoa,
there's like 120 breeds of chickens. I've been working on a book about breeds of chickens, so I know.
Well, I'm anxious to see that book.
It will be out next spring.
And what's the title of that book?
That is going to be Story's Illustrated Guide to Poultry.
And your most recent book, that's the Hobby Farm Live Your Rural Dream.
Right. And that's a really good starting out book for, you know, say somebody who's still living, you know, has a quarter acre lot in town, but dreams of doing these things and getting into gardening and getting into small-scale animal production. And maybe they dream of eventually moving to a real farm. But, you know, it's a good start out of the gate book.
What do you think the psychological effect is of having a farmer livestock relationship with animals that's different from a pet relationship?
It is different. I mean, they can still be somewhat pet-like. But you also have to keep in mind that they're there for work purposes. I don't know. I love having the animals around. I love going out and petting animals, feeding the chickens, just being around all these critters. They make my life. They have some disadvantages. We don't get to take vacations together.
No. Do you get to take vacations? Do you have somebody come and take care of your animals?
I travel, or Ken travels, but we don't travel together because of it. We used to have Ken's dad in his somewhat younger days was able to come take care of animals for us, but now he's getting a little bit long in the tooth for that responsibility. So, and we haven't found anybody else. The one time we left years ago and left person we knew a little bit in charge of our animals, one of them got hurt really badly. Not that person's fault, but it still was, you know, an unfair burden on that person then, and I think decisions would have been made differently had we been here and been able to take care of the animal.
Yeah, emotionally speaking, even if the economic values were the same, it's a lot more of a responsibility to take care of somebody's animals than it is to step in and take care of their garden if they were to take a week or two vacation.
Darn tootin'. I had a person recently email me from Michigan, I think she lived in, and she said, well, she owned land up there, and she'd read my small-scale livestock book, but she traveled every year to Florida to do some work down there in the winter for like 3 months a year, and that work was lucrative to her, and so she couldn't give it up completely. And, you know, did I think she could get a beef cattle herd and just kind of pay a neighbor to look after them for 3 months or so a year? And I mean, I said to her, I don't think that would be a good approach. I think if you want to do something in part of the year in Michigan, you can do, you know, a stocker cattle arrangement where you take care of a local farmer, say, young cattle. He brings them, he drops them off, pays you to feed them on your pasture and make sure the water tank is full every day and that kind of thing. But I would be disinclined to buy a herd of animals and just leave them for 3 months, hoping that someone was taking good care of them.
Yeah, somebody who doesn't own them and doesn't have that much financial stake in them.
No.
Well, in your book, Small-Scale Livestock Farming, A Grass-Based Approach for Health, Sustainability, and Profit, you talk about the various tools that are available to the small-scale farmer or rancher. And the top three that you list are mind, labor, and money. Would you say a little bit about those three?
You know, people think, oh, that if they buy a tractor or this or that, that's going to, you know, that's the things they need. But really, the top one is what's in your brain. You need to think. You need to be a critical thinker at every phase of your operation to know why you want to do things, why you're making choices. And so that's kind of the most important tool to me. And if you're managing land and managing animals, you know, being out, walk the land, look at it, know what's going on, understand the ramifications of a drought, say. Those are things you have to have, and people who don't have that really don't make very good farmers. Labor, it is a lot of work. There's no two ways about it. And even on the hobby level, it can be a lot of work. You know, you have to be willing to get up every day of the year and take care of those critters and take care of that garden during its season of when it calls for labor. And you have to do that consistently. If it needs irrigating, it needs irrigating. You don't get to say, well, I'm going to blow that off today. You know, I mean, this is the reality. It's not as easy as going to the grocery store to pick up all your food.
And then there's money.
And in this day and age and in this society, you can't live without it. So one of the other things, I recently talked to a young woman who's still in college who wants to farm, and, you know, she was like, talking about, well, she would really like a place that had pretty wooden fences instead of electric fences because, you know, she's got this vision in her mind. And I said to her, well, that's great, but you have to make up your mind, you know, do you want to farm or do you want to have a pretty place? And how much money do you have? Because the pretty wooden fencing costs a whole lot more. It might work, and if you have enough money to make that investment, spare cash on hand, yeah, that's a fine decision to make. But if you're going to have to go borrow money to buy fencing material, you don't want to buy the most expensive and least practical fence. You don't want to be paying interest on that kind of an investment because that investment's not going to pay you back on your farm. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. So you mentioned before we actually got into the interview proper that you were using solar power out on your property and that you are off the grid. Is that right?
Right. We are, I guess, about probably 4 miles away from the nearest electric pole and the nearest telephone line. And so we use solar panels to do the electric for the house, runs the computer, runs the lights, the television, that kind of thing. We do have a generator to run our well pump. When we bought this place, it had the generator set up, and the well pump is very deep, so we decided to continue with that for now because it would have cost us a lot of money to get a sufficient solar array to run that pump. Though we keep talking about moving in that direction. And we have a radio telephone. We don't have landlines for our telephone, so we're kind of completely off the grid on all modern services out here.
So you've got your internet through the phone line, is that right?
We have our internet through the radio phone system.
Oh, the radio phone system. So you're not even dependent on any wire out to your house.
There's not a wire out here from anything, nope.
Well, that sort of leads into my next line of questioning, which is society at large. I think, I don't know the exact nature of the transformation, but I think we are on the verge of a very big transformation that's going to result from mainly our technology and the fact that the sources of energy that we have been relying upon are going to be running out, and we are going to be faced with a radical and necessary reorganization of our society, including how we feed ourselves. And I have recently moved out to a rural area because I don't want to be in or near a major population center if things do get a little turbulent in this transition. Also, I would like to be off the grid as you are. I'm not yet. I'm still on rural water, and I still have I'm dependent on the local electric company for my power. But I certainly would like to move in the direction of being completely self-sufficient in that regard. My question to you is there any element of the survivalist paradigm in your lifestyle?
Well, I guess we're pretty well prepared if it came down to that, but I don't do this out of a survivalist mindset, I guess. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm one of those people, some days I'm a glass half full person and some days I'm a glass half empty. I do believe we are nearing peak oil or there, and peak oil, of course, is something that you'll see in the rearview mirror. So we're not going to know today is peak oil today or is it next year. We're, you know, 5 years from now, we may be able to say, oh, that's when peak oil happened, but, you know, it'll be looking backward. But, yeah, it's very close, and I think now, we need, as a society, to start a dialogue about that transition, because if we don't start a dialogue about that transition, it could get pretty ugly in places.
Well, let me tell you, the main focus of the Sea Realm podcast from week to week is preparation for that transition.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about it from a variety of angles. Sometimes they're public policy-oriented, sometimes they are technology-oriented, and in this case, they are... We're talking about changing our relationship to the earth, to the natural biological and ecological systems that we depend upon. But the exact forms of the discussion change radically from week to week. You are the first in a while of the sort of earth-centered, holistic management-oriented guests that I've had. Recently it's all been public policy, mm-hmm. talking about the drug war and such things. Let me ask you a question about guns. Do you keep firearms on the property?
Oh, we do. Yeah.
Okay. Is that just rifles, or do you have handguns as well?
We have some of both. My husband grew up in a family that hunted, and family has been many generations in Colorado and have that kind of a rural ethic, and so, yeah, we definitely have guns here. I do believe that people should raise some of their own food. I mean, you should know how to do it for survival if push comes to shove. You should also do it because it's the right damn thing to do. I mean, I think anybody can have a pot with a tomato plant in it and some herbs on a windowsill, even if you live in the city. So, you know, I believe that is an important part of our transitioning, is getting people back to being somewhat self-sufficient. This is a hard society to be fully self-sufficient in, but at least getting back to partial self-sufficiency. And with the changes in energy systems, I mean, I'm optimistic that there is a lot of new technology and renewable energy that can help us over that hump. There are really exciting changes going on in solar development that's going to make solar a lot more economical for people. Now the newer, the flexi solar that can go on a metal roof of a building and things, I mean, that's, to me, very exciting to see this technology, and worldwide to see that there's a growing enough interest in it that it is going to bring the price down to where right now wind and solar are finally becoming comparable with other energy sources. So, I mean, you know, for the first time you're seeing where, yeah, it can be a cost-effective payback period. I did an article for a magazine recently on a new solar lighting technology that was developed at Oak Ridge National Lab, and that has a collector that could also be used to light the inside of buildings, and a tremendous amount of our national energy. In fact, the equivalent of all of our nuclear power plants goes to indoor lighting during daylight hours, which I didn't know till I did this article, and it was an overwhelming number of watts, megawatts a year going for that purpose. And you think, if you walk into, I notice you are from the area that Walmart's from, walk into a Walmart anywhere in the country, doesn't matter if the sun's outside bright and shiny, the lights are all on. So, you know, this technology could change that to where if it's sunny out, the indoors of a Walmart are being lit by sun. And stripping off part of the infrared part of the light system to go to solar panels at the same time. So there's things like that that to me are really exciting and positive for the future.
Well, while we're on the topic of technology, well, no, it doesn't necessarily have to be the end. While we're on the topic of technology, let me ask you about genomic technology. What are your thoughts about introducing genes from other organisms into our food crops and into the animals that we have domestically co-evolved with and kept with us over the past few hundred or a few thousand years?
That is not technology I like. I have major concerns with the genetic manipulation going on, just like I have major concerns with where nanotechnology is going and how quickly it's moving out into the marketplace with too little testing. So I think, you know, the genetic, I think it was a very sad day when the Supreme Court agreed that life could be patented, because that has moved a whole lot of our decision-making and has allowed corporate America and world corporations to control life. And I think that's a bad thing for us in the long run. To that end, I still grow all open pollinated varieties, but, you know, they can be contaminated by drift. So I'm really very apprehensive about what those things might mean in the future.
I'd very much like to come back and revisit many of these issues with you. I think that's pretty much all the time that we're going to have for today. But, Carol Icarius, I would like to thank you for appearing on the Sea Realm podcast and sharing your ideas with us.
Well, I am pleased to have been able to talk to you today. Thank you so much.
And that really is all the time we have for this episode of the Sea Realm podcast. I'm going to leave you with a song by Ken Woodard, Carol Icarius' husband. This is a song called Bare Bones. I hope you'll join us next week for another installment of the Sea Realm podcast. Stay well.
Stripping things down to the bare bones, giving up on politicians, picture taking cell phone. I'll keep my freedom, freedom to think on my own. Stripping things down to the bare bone. Stripping things down to the bare bone. Keep my old truck home out on the range. Throw out some thoughts, the ones that seem strange. Take the clutter in my mind, spread it like ashes when I've got the time. I'll keep my freedom, freedom to think on my own. Stripping things down to the bare bone. Stripping things down to the bare bone. Then I tone down my music, take out a note or two. Silence can never have too few. Stop thinking like I'm supposed to. Running with the pack instead of the few. Yippee, says a Kyle in the city. A lot of people hate me, but I'm still free. Bare bones, gonna strip things down. Bare bones, got too much stuff around. Bare bones, more quiet, less sound. Bare bones, less is more I found. I'll keep my freedom, freedom to think on my own. Stripping things down to the bare bone. Stripping things down to the bare bone. Stripping things down to the bare bone. Stripping things down to the bare bone.